As I turned 14 and then 15 years old, my soft zone training was really put to the test. The competition for the top of the American Scholastic Chess ranking was stiffened by a tremendous influx of Soviet immigrants. As the Soviet Union fell apart, many of the powerful Russian players looked for opportunity in the West. These kids were highly trained, excellent fighters, who'd been schooled in the famous Pioneers' Palaces of Moscow and Leningrad. Pioneers' Palaces were state-funded youth centers in the USSR, in which dedicated children were trained in specific disciplines. These schools were famous for pumping out highly professionalized young chess players. Most Pioneers' Palaces were shut down with the fall of the Soviet Union. Many of these new rivals were armed with a repertoire of psychological tricks that presented serious challenges. One of the more interesting tactics was implemented by a Russian boy, whom I had trouble with for a period of months before I caught on to his game. He was a very strong player, so our clashes were always tense, but for some reason I tended to make careless errors against him in the critical positions. Then one day an old Bulgarian master named Rudy Blumenfeld approached my father in the Marshall Chess Club and asked him if we were aware of what this boy was doing to me. We were not. He explained that in the climactic moments of the struggle, when I had to buckle down and patiently work my way through the complications to find a precise solution, this boy would start to tap a chess piece on the side of the table, barely audible, but at a pace that entered and slightly quickened my mental process. This subtle tactic was highly effective, and I later found out that it was an offspring of the Soviet study of hypnosis and mind control. The next time we played, I was on the lookout for the tapping, and sure enough, in the critical moment, it was right there. Hilarious. Once I was aware of what was happening, I was able to turn the tables in our rivalry. Some of the other young Russian players were far less subtle and had tricks that crossed the borders of sporting ethics. One of these boys, who was my arch rival for years, had the habit of kicking me under the table during the critical moments of a game. He would also get up from the board at tournaments and talk about the position in Russian with his coach, a famous grandmaster. There were complaints, but little was done to stop the cheating. No one could prove what was discussed because of the language barrier, and the truth is that it didn't even matter. While valuable chess ideas might have been exchanged, the psychological effect was much more critical. Opponents felt helpless and wronged. They took on the mentality of victim, and so half the battle was already lost. More than once I watched top young American players reduced to tears by this kid, but these dirty tactics were not reserved for local soil. In 1993, when we were 16, this Russian boy and I both traveled to India to jointly represent America in the World Under 21 Championship, and a formal protest was lodged against the American team by 7 or 8 delegations because he was blatantly cheating at the event. Competitors from all over the world approached me and demanded to know how the Americans could do such a thing. I was embarrassed to be associated with this kid and his seedy repertoire. As a result of this shift of tone in the U.S. scholastic scene, many of my American contemporaries became dispirited and quit the game. The Russian kids were great players who presented a whole new set of challenges, and instead of adapting and raising their games, American kids dropped out. For my part, this new crew of brilliant Machiavellian rivals made me buckle down. I had my home turf to defend, and the first step would be to learn how to handle dirty opponents without losing my cool. Sometimes noticing the psychological tactic was enough to render it harmless, but in the case of the kicking and barefaced cheating, I really had to take on my emotions. These breaks from etiquette were outrageous in the chess world, and I was appalled. The problem is that when I got angry, I was thrown off my game. I tried to stay level-headed, but this one rival of mine had no limits. He would push me to the point of utter exasperation, and I would often self-destruct. I've come to believe that the solution to this type of situation does not lie in denying our emotions, but in learning to use them to our advantage. Instead of stifling myself, I needed to channel my mood into heightened focus, and I can't honestly say that I figured out how to do this consistently until years into my martial arts career, when dirty opponents try to take out my knees, target the groin, or headbutt me in the nose in competition. My whole life, I've worked on this issue. Mental resilience is arguably the most critical trait of a world-class performer, and it should be nurtured continuously. Left to my own devices, I'm always looking for ways to become more and more psychologically impregnable. When uncomfortable, my instinct is not to avoid the discomfort, but to become at peace with it. When injured, which happens frequently in the life of a martial artist, I try to avoid painkillers and to change the sensation of pain into a feeling that's not necessarily negative. My instinct is always to seek out challenges as opposed to avoiding them.